Is there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us. Welcome, everyone. We talked a lot last episode on Bickham's idea of seeing goals, and we wanted to find out if our listeners, who are published writers and professional editors, agreed. Spoiler alert, everyone thinks plot goals are important, but there's nuance in their approaches.
My name is Doris Sue, and I'm the author of Hold On, Please, Emily. And this is a young adult book. It's also a little bit of a romance and a tale that's very inspirational.
In his book, Scene and Structure, Jack Bickham is fairly adamant that each scene has a protagonist trying to achieve a goal. Do you structure your scenes this way?
Not every single scene, I feel, is structured in this way. But for the most part, many scenes are. For Jack Bickham, you have a scene goal, and then you have a conflict, and then you have a tactical disaster. And I find that sometimes it spreads across multiple scenes. I can actually give you an example of that in my book. In the beginning of my story, we learn that Emily writes song lyrics in a Moleskine, and readers have no idea that it's actually leading up to a potential conflict. Later on in the book, when she ends up dropping her Moleskine and it lands in the hands of a stranger who just so happens to have the audacity to go through her notebook, and later on in the book ends up being her love interest and plays a very important role when she faces a bigger conflict.
So you had a scene that didn't have a conflict, but was critical for a conflict you were setting up later.
Exactly. And I feel that as an author, that's essentially what we do because we don't want to make it too obvious for the readers. Then there's no curiosity and you won't be able to connect with those characters.
So whereas Bickham is very adamant that your goal should be stated very early on and someone should be able to identify the goal, you trust your readers to figure it out without directly stating it.
There are cases where we need to be very clear, like the main goal in the story. My main goal is that she has this dream to become a musician. And I do that right away. And I make it very clear in chapter one of my book with her at her parents' gravestone, paying her respects, and they know that she's an orphan. So there's all these conflicts and problems that could limit her or at least challenge her to achieve those dreams. But we're very clear that this is her dream because she's talking to her parents and saying that I'm going to make you proud. I'm going to do this. At the same time, there are times, like you said, you just have to trust the reader. You need to give readers that flexibility to mold themselves into the story because good books bring the reader into the story. They become part of the story and they feel that emotional connect and want to, you know, turn the page. It's not necessarily the secret, but I feel what really can support a good quality, well-written story.
My name is Chris Hargett and I co-wrote with Jenny Ludwig a book called Images of Africa, a comical couple safari saga.
Do you have a scene goal for each of your scenes?
Yes, with varying levels of discipline and rear view perspective. Sometimes with 20/20 hindsight, I go, oh, that's really what the character was after. And it came out a little bit further into the scene than I would like. And I have to go back to the very first paragraph and see if I can bring it to prominence there. Other times I've gone through and made a spreadsheet of every chapter and said, okay, what did the character want and what was the obstacle? And then did it resolve with a yes and or a no but or a yes and therefore?
So you say you agree in principle, but you don't always get to it in practice.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
This book that you're currently writing is genre fantasy. You've written a radically different book previously. Did that one, which was nonfiction and The musings of a couple on a trip to Africa also include seeing goals?
With that one, there were times when it was a little more drifty, right? Just like real life, when you're a tourist, there's a certain sense of disorientation once you've been on the road long enough. And we were going for that feeling to try and convey that to the reader. You know, you've traveled 20,000 miles and you've been on the road 10 days and you are a little road weary and punch drunk. So sometimes there's a little more of a tone poem thing going on. That was a more experimental thing in some ways. But I would say even there, there's a clear goal. There's a chapter where Jenny's passport goes missing and she wants to stop the entire tour, skip the best part of the trip to the massive safari park that we've been dreaming about for years, and go to the capital and the consulate and get a new passport. And her traveling partner, myself, is very much in conflict with this goal, thinking that that is horribly misguided. And hopefully the reader is on my side, or at least feeling the tension. But then, you know, there's other chapters where we're like trying to see animals and trying to take cool pictures and trying to make people laugh. And sometimes those experiential bits of fan service get in the way, I think, of clear scene structure.
I'm Kristen Tate. I am a freelance book editor. I own a company called The Blue Garret.
When you get the book or you get the manuscript and you're reading through it and you're critiquing a scene, do you look for a scene goal?
I'm not looking for a character goal for every scene, but I do want every scene to have a reason to be there. And I will say that 100% of the time, I will find at least one scene in a manuscript, one of the author's darlings. Often it's a particular setting and they've always envisioned it as part of the book. And yet nothing actually happens or changes in that scene that impacts the overall book.
When the scene goal is also the protagonist's goal, do you feel that it needs to be stated clearly, or do you trust the readers to figure it out?
I know Jack Bickham thinks it's an always. I'm not a fan of always, especially when it comes to fiction. I just don't think there are absolute rules. Even in genre fiction that is very plot heavy, I think you can really trust the reader to know what the protagonist's goal is going to be in certain cases. For example, two kinds of scenes where you don't need to necessarily open with the protagonist stating their goal. One is we've got a scene that's coming directly after a cliffhanger. If you've set that cliffhanger up correctly, the reader should have a really great idea of what is going through the protagonist's head. So I've just been doing an analysis of Jesse Sutanto's excellent rom-com, Dial A for Aunties, on my blog. It's kind of Weekend at Bernie's meets Crazy Rich Asians. The protagonist, Mehdi, accidentally kills her blind date. Chapter 3 ends with her tasering this blind date who's driving her off to this remote area to assault her.
So not accidentally as in, oh, I guess that soup was off that I fed you.
She didn't mean to kill him. It was like self-defense and he had it coming and she's just tasing him. But we know when that scene ends, there are a few possibilities that she's going to need to confront when we see her again. Like the car is wrecked. We know that. It feels like it would be overkill to state it. So that's one situation. If you ended on a cliffhanger and you open the next chapter, like get right into it. We know. Second case is a chapter beginning, especially if you've had a couple really fast-paced chapters, a chapter beginning can be a really nice place to stitch in some introspection, a little bit of backstory, some memory, you know, give us some broader context. You don't want to spend more than a few paragraphs doing that. Don't do that in the first chapter. Maybe don't even do it in the first five, but I think there's room to do that. Those are my two exceptions.
Thank you to all our guests. You can find links to their books and services in our show notes. And now, on to more Bickham. In today's episode, we're moving beyond scene basics into more advanced concerns. Like, does that disaster you crafted for the end of your scene have the proper scale, immediacy, finality? And does it steer your story in the right direction? And we haven't gotten that pig home yet. In chapter 6, Bickham points out, with two numbered lists, other things that can go wrong. So we're covering a lot of useful stuff in this episode.
Today we're working on chapter 5 and chapter 6. Chapter 5, structure in macrocosm, scenes with results.
I can say, as a trained scientist, I have read journal articles that are more straightforward than his chapter names. What basically this is about is he's building on what we talked about last time of what makes up a scene, what can go wrong. Even if you follow his advice of having a stated goal, evolving conflict, and a disaster.
And he puts the errors in kind of categories. The categories are scope, immediacy, finality, and direction. And this is mostly having to do with goal selection. For scope, the goal can be too broad or too narrow. Or it can be an insignificant goal. It could be like a petty matter. And his example was, will Fred get good boots?
It's very much a Goldilocks thing. It has to be just right.
Goldilocks. Is that Goldilocks and Three Bears? Yeah.
This goal is too large. This goal is too petty. The one I found interesting here was the immediacy of the goal. It sounds really good. It's going to be hard to do in genres that aren't like thriller based or very immediate. The idea is you should have a goal that has a result that comes at the end of the scene. How would you explain it?
So Bickham says that the careful writer of fiction wants the disaster which grows out of the goal to put considerable additional pressure on the character very soon. So essentially what he's saying is, in order to string the story together, your goal has to have immediacy. If the goal is not something that needs to be attained right away, right? It's like something that's going to keep going on and on and on. How do you end the scene, right? It needs to be something they need to attain because your reader's going to get bored and bogged down because they're not getting some kind of conclusion.
Right. So he has the example of Fred possibly getting funding for his expedition from the Smithsonian Institute or something, but the Smithsonian Institute isn't going to meet for 3 months. So that goal, that beginning, that scene can't be realized within the scene. And now you either do a time cut for 3 months and you get results, or you put more plot in between. But in either case, Bickham says it won't work. It won't cause people to keep turning the page. And he is right. I mean, no one's going to like get to the end and say, oh, shall we see if the grant comes in or not?
Right. It creates what Bickham calls an indefinite delay. It's almost like, well, if you're procrastinating, right, and your deadline's 3 months from now, and then you don't do it until the day before. You just keep putting it off and putting it off. The reader, though, is not going to put it off.
Or maybe what you'd have to do for that particular scene is you'd have to make the goal Fred getting the application in on time.
Yeah.
And that way, even though you wouldn't hear what the result was, the actual goal of will Fred make it to the post office and have the proper money to buy the stamps to send it, you could have that be your disaster, him not getting there in time, but not the 3 months later.
Right. It is also similar to like getting your goals as a person, like a book. A book is a big thing. You probably don't want to write a scene where he's writing a book and every time he's...
I think you really shouldn't write a book about writing a book.
It's happened before. People have done it.
And people will continue to do that. Unfortunately, I think it's a crutch. Like, I can't write a book, so I'll write about somebody writing a book. It doesn't really broaden you. And second of all, the problem is that some really, really good writers have done it already, and you're not going to top them or bring anything new to the experience.
I don't know if I would agree with that. Everyone who writes their book is going to sound similar to somebody else's book, but it's going to be your book. So it's going to be different because you're not necessarily like everybody else. But yes, it can be overdone, like this writing in the second person. That can become tacky after a while.
My problem with this advice is that often I have bigger goals for a character. Like in my fantasy, I have my characters plopped down in the world and they are looking for their quest. If I were to write it like Bickham, I would have plopped them down the world and immediately had them have a fight and have some injuries and have all these other things. And I unfortunately have characters that aren't ready to have their quest yet. So I'm slowing it down. But the immediacy isn't there. And I know it's not there. I totally get why Bickham's saying this. I recognize that this is something you should do. But sometimes I feel like a story doesn't fit in a scene with, you know, achieved goal or a disaster at every end of the scene. Sometimes you have something that's longer and it's not immediate. So how does one deal with that?
Okay, so the way I think about it, anyway, is that it may not seem like a disaster, but it is. Even though it might be small, it could still be immediate. Just because big stuff isn't happening doesn't mean that the little things don't matter. And so they can still be structured in this way, and they're not going to necessarily feel like you're fulfilling some formula. You're structuring them so that the little things are entertaining, right? Like there was that scene, you read it a few episodes ago, and your main character went into this woman's office, total bureaucrat, also somebody who has not been nice to her in the past. And in the beginning, she seems to be almost berating her. I'm going to punish you. And it's not like that's something that's super big in the story. It's there to kind of, I think, explain why Sophie gets this job when she doesn't necessarily have a lot of skill in it. But there was so much drama, and there was a clear goal, and there was a disaster at the end. Even if it was in her favor, it still ended in a quote-unquote disaster style, no and therefore, or yes but. That, in that form, made it interesting to me as the reader, because I think that's the point of all this. The point of structuring it this way is to make the reader interested, even in the small scenes.
But then you fall back on that whole scope.
Well, that's the thing, right? Goldilocks. Not too big, not too small. He did say something about making things too immediate. Yes, you want the results to be kind of immediate. There's some goal they have to attain right away, even if it's a small goal. But apparently, you can do this too much where there's so many goals and they're getting knocked out one by one that it makes the plot unrealistic. Probably like a Michael Bay movie. Think of that last Michael Bay movie. You will never get those hours back from the most recent, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or whatever. Or what was the other one he did?
Transformers.
Oh my God. It was like 3 hours. 3 hours. And it was just like ridiculous because it was like explosion, 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 explosion. You get desensitized. So there are errors in immediacy.
I really liked his diagnosis of why people don't put enough conflict in their scenes.
Oh yeah, the 38-pound weakling, he called it.
His reasons were shyness, fear, and fatigue. And he had a little bit of a diagnosis for each of them. The first one was shyness, or what almost to me seems like Midwestern nice. You just don't want to step on anyone's toes, and you don't want to step outside that comfort zone.
I'm not from the Midwest, so I'm not sure about that. The things I got from that is when you're shy or you have this 98-pound weakling, your character is a wuss. It's a weak character problem. Your character has to have some kind of agency. And it's a result of I hate to say the word weak writer, but it's a shy writer, like you said, where people don't want to cause waves or they're trying to save the big stuff for later. My problem is not having conflict. My problem is having too much conflict, too many explosions. And then I'm like, but which ones do I choose? I think your main character has lots of...
Oh, it's something I've worked on. My initial stories were not... They were weak characters. They were much more ambivalent. The natural idea is I'm just going to take an everyday person and then throw them into something crazy. And unfortunately, that really limits you at the beginning of your story for how to move things forward or to engage the reader. So yeah, you have to have strong characters. The next one he said was fear, which is a very natural one. And that he diagnosed with people just not feeling comfortable writing certain scenes. People not comfortable writing a fight scene or a sword fight scene or a nuclear bomb going off or something where you're having to push yourself outside your comfort zone.
Right. I've seen this in a lot of memoir workshops where if people are talking about themselves as children, themselves as a character doesn't have any agency because you have no control as a child.
Well, I think that goes more to the shyness. So what this is talking about for a memoirist that has to dig into some family history that they don't really want to think about.
Oh, I see. They are afraid of the backlash.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They are afraid of someone saying, you got that wrong. So they don't want to even touch it. They just want to like skip ahead and just mention it briefly. And Bickham rightly says that you're not going to grow as a writer unless you attempt to write these scenes.
So be brave, dear listener. Be brave.
You can always rewrite it.
Yeah, you probably have a workshop group, right? Your workshop group can tell you.
And finally, we have fatigue, where you're just too damn tired to write the damn scene.
Or the damn book. No, that's just me.
And Bickham says, you know, sometimes you just have to take a break.
Mm-hmm.
Go back and do the day job for a while, or step away from the computer. As long as it doesn't go by weeks and weeks and weeks in procrastination, I think that's a good advice. Like, when you are sick and tired of writing a scene, take a break.
Other things he discussed, which I thought were important, the finality of the disaster. When that disaster happens, when Fred doesn't get the loan, he doesn't get the loan. Can't come in later and then say he gets it. It has to matter. It has to throw them backwards in some way. It can't be a tiny annoyance.
Disaster taking you in the wrong direction. I think that was tied into, you insert a disaster which takes you off the track of the story goal and you can't get back. In this case, if Fred injures himself and becomes paralyzed, he's not going to be able to climb the mountain. You've diverted from your initial goal of the story. So your disasters, we'll talk further about like how they all have to work together. But here, if you throw in a disaster that's so great that it derails the story, then you can't recover. And I actually love the fact that at this point, we got away from Fred and we actually went to one of Bickham's stories where he revealed that he had caused his character to leave town and suddenly he wasn't around all the quirky characters and the whole story fell apart.
Right.
And it was at a certain point where someone said, oh, that guy you want to talk to, he's no longer in town. So his character had to leave. And so what he did was he made sure that guy was in town, but other reasons why the main character couldn't interview him, he had to rework the whole story from that point. It wasn't like you fix this one point and then everything all works. He had to rewrite the whole thing because that disaster took him in the wrong direction.
He did have another Fred example where poor Fred, what if you gave him a heart attack at the end of the scene? I'm like, well, now he's in an invalid or he's in the hospital. You've totally derailed your entire story. I mean, maybe you can make it work, but you want to be careful. Don't give this big super stuff that will mess up your whole character. And then it totally changes the story, right? What if he robs the bank? I think that was another one. Maybe he robs the bank. Well, now he's a criminal. And unless that's what you wanted your story to be, you know, Fred the criminal, you've just derailed your entire story.
There's an entire category of stories that starts off with one goal and completely goes off the rails in a delightful way. And the audience is just along for the ride.
Do you have an example?
Well, any Coen Brothers movie? I mean,
would you call like Thor Ragnarok?
That does have a bit of it. Thor Ragnarok, which starts off as a very standard Thor needs to save his country. And he discovers his father's missing, so he goes in search of his father. So you think the story is, well, will Thor rescue his father? Well, it turns out his father didn't really need rescuing and his father's dying. His father dies, and then suddenly the sister shows up out of nowhere. So now that's the one that he's fighting. And then he gets zapped to a garbage planet, and the Hulk shows up. So we are vastly detouring. And in the end, it does actually end up being him saving his country, or actually not saving his country. It surprises us with where it goes. And I think that's a valid form of storytelling. But it's not Jack Bickham's form of storytelling, at least not at this point in the book.
Right.
And that was chapter 5. And chapter 6 is looking at your story as a whole and seeing how your scenes work together.
So chapter 6 is planning and revising scenes for maximum effect.
Bickham uses a lot of numbers here. He actually uses 2 sets of numbers. But we're going to start with the first set, which is...
I've started calling him the bullet point king.
So the first set are about linking scenes. He's got 7 points.
And he covered 1 through 3 already pretty extensively. So this chapter focuses on 4 through 7. So number 4 is once a viewpoint has been established and that viewpoint character's problem and goal have been stated, it's wise to remain with that same single viewpoint through the disaster.
And I think we've covered viewpoints, so let's jump to the next one.
We have a whole chapter show notes on that in the Gardner episode. So if you want point of view, the general rule is don't switch point of view character in the middle of a scene. It confuses the heck out of everybody.
And for Bickham, he's saying that people are following character A for their goal and you switch to character B. Character B doesn't necessarily have the same goal. So you've lost that whole agreement he has in the scenes.
Number five is disaster works or moves the story forward by seeming to move the central figure further back from his or her goal, leaving him or her in worse trouble than he was before the scene started.
Bickham goes to an old story he used to be heard as a child about a woman trying to get her pig over a stile. Do you remember that one from your childhood?
I'd never read that one, but I loved his retelling of it. It seemed delightful.
I remember that one, actually. It's a classic character wants one thing, but can't get it from the next character, so they keep going down the line. It's the equivalent of the old woman that swallowed a spider.
Yeah, that one reminded me of that one.
So this woman is trying to get her pig that she bought over the gate to get home. The pig won't come, so she asks a stick to beat the pig, but the stick won't do it. So she's got to get something to motivate the stick, so she finds a fire and says, well, fire, burn the stick to hit the pig to get me home, and so forth and so forth all the way down the line. With each step, she's getting further from this pig and her goal of getting the pig over, and she's acquiring more problems, because now not only does she have to deal with that pig, she has to deal with that stick and that puddle of water and that cow and all the way down the line. And at the very end, she finally convinces someone to start the domino effect, and it all goes through and the pig goes over the stile. But from person reading it, it seems like she's getting in a worse and worse and worse and worse shape. So the question is, how do you write a story like that?
This is the key that gets me, is things get worse, but it still moves the plot forward. Metaphorically, this is kind of like walking up a dune. When your character is going through their disasters, at each scene they have a goal. They never truly meet that goal. They kind of do sometimes, but whenever they're moving forward through the story, they're taking three steps forward, two steps back. It's like walking up a dune. Bickham says, well-planned scenes end with disasters that tighten the noose around the lead character's necks. They make things worse, not better. They eliminate hoped-for avenues of progress. They increase the lead character's worry, sense of possible failure, and desperation, so that in all these ways, the main character in a novel of 400 pages will be in far worse shape by page 200 than he seems to be at the outset.
If you're writing a novel where you actually are stopping every good idea you have for your protagonist to get to the end and make a disaster, by the end of it, it's going to be like real life. The options are really poor. So what I'm saying is, when planning a novel like this, pick the route you want your character to go for and how they're going to achieve the success, and then just figure out a way to make it look like they're not going to get it the whole way by knocking out other options. For example, let's say it's a romance, and all that's required is for the two characters to sit together and tell each other that they love each other or that they like each other. It's one of those like comedy of errors where people keep getting in the way of the characters from having this conversation. You're writing your story to have the characters have the conversation at the end where it really matters. So what you're doing is you're coming up with a series of disasters to keep them from that. But you know what the end result is going to be. You know where you want the story to end. You'll write it in such a way that the reader think, well, of course, Mr. Darcy needs to tell Elizabeth this thing, but there's this person standing in the way that screws everything up. But as a writer, you had planned on having a character stand in the way, so you wouldn't have the confession scene happen early on. Bickham presents this as an analytical way. If someone's looking at a novel that's already written, they'll say, oh, look, there are all these disasters. But as a writer, you don't have to destroy your best plot because you want a disaster. You can keep that plot and just come up with alternatives that have the disasters.
Right. Well, that's how you get a 400-page novel.
That's how you get a good 400-page novel.
A good 400-page novel. He also had a couple other quotes. He called this thing the funnel effect. Like Kim was saying, you're knocking out all of the easy routes, and you're making it so that there's no other choice but to go the path that they have to take. You know what it is, but your character doesn't know what it is.
And your reader doesn't know what it is.
But you are creating this funnel effect. So the seeming a backward movement is only, quote unquote, dramatic illusion. I thought it was a great line. There was another t-shirt quote in this, by the way. It was, it's axiomatic among professional novelists that when things are going hideously for the lead character, the book is probably going along just wonderfully. Thank you.
You wear really long t-shirts, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Okay, maybe that's not a good one.
How about when things are going wrong, they're really going right?
Yeah, there you go.
Point number six.
Readers will put up with a lot if your scenes will only keep making things worse.
Furthermore, he said one other thing about the writing and stuff like that.
Let me read it myself. I'll find it here.
They will put up with a lot of plot tinkering and even some cumbersome writing on your part now and again if you keep things getting worse in this way. Exclamation mark. And I was thinking, yes, I have plowed through certain books that I did not enjoy reading because I just wanted to see how it ended up.
Yeah.
But I will also say that when I got to the end of reading those books, I was not particularly fond of the writer or the book. So while you can get away with a lot by making the thing worse and worse for the character, you might not endear yourself to the reader if that's all your book has.
Yeah, there was a book I read, I think they're making a show out of it, which I think will make a great show, called Rust.
Quick correction. The title of the book Renee's referring to is Wool.
So it was gigantic. A lot of it was self-published, not to say there's anything wrong with that. The plot was fantastic. The writing drove me crazy. It was so overly described, things that just did not need a description. And it bogged the story down. But I read the whole damn thing because the plot was really good. That didn't mean by the end of the book I wasn't exhausted and annoyed. Because I still am. You can kind of hear it in my voice. I'm still a bit annoyed.
It's amazing how well we remember bad books.
Yeah. But you don't want to be that writer, right? I don't want to be that writer that even though I have a good plot, the writing was just meh.
Seemed to do pretty well for the guy that wrote Rust.
I'm not like saying he's bad. I'm just saying that I did not appreciate the writing style. But I'm giving him chops here. It's like, hey man, he had a really good plot. So much so that I kept barreling through. Because I had to know what happened next.
Proof of what Bickham's saying.
And then number 7. This one I thought was really interesting. You can seldom, if ever, plan, write, or revise a scene in isolation of your other plans for your story because the end of each scene dictates a lot about what can happen later. So essentially, he says change is threatening. Your story starts with change, but the disaster at the end of every scene signifies new change, which is newly threatening. And in this way, the character is always changing and always adapting.
The idea is your story starts with the character experiencing some change and they want to get back to where they were. You throw something right at the beginning and then you continue to throw things at them throughout the story. Just like the change at the beginning of the story changed your character, all further disasters will also change your character. And I liked his term, meaningful change. Which comes down to it's not enough to just throw a bunch of disasters or a bunch of drama if not changing your character in the right way for them to succeed at the end.
It doesn't have to be a gigantic change, but a change nonetheless. I'm going to bring up Breaking Bad again for the Breaking Bad fans like I am. There's some scenes where you wonder how did this weakling character, Walter White, teaching high school, become this like crazy drug lord guy? Well, there was this one scene where he had somebody tied up in his basement. The fact that he did that alone with Jesse, they didn't know what to do with him. They're like, oh God, he's going to tell on us or whatever. So like, they just did the easiest, fastest thing they could do. We'll just tie him up. We'll figure it out later. Well, this weakling is now a kidnapper. He was put in a situation and that made him move the goalpost and changed his character. He was treating him like a student. Like, oh, you poor kid. I mean, he made the guy a sandwich. Well, the plate breaks that he gives him the sandwich on, and he realizes a shard is missing when he's upstairs doing the dishes, which means that he knows the guy downstairs now has a weapon. And then he has to be murdered. Now, Walter White is a murderer by the end of that. It's like, see how the choices that he makes in light of these disasters change him as a person.
Right. If he had simply killed the guy right from the beginning as an accident in a confrontation, that would have been dramatic, but it wouldn't have been a meaningful change. As it is, we have taken Walter White from this chemistry teacher to someone who is capable and knows he's capable of a lot. Right. These are all meaningful disasters. They service the larger plot of the story and your character's arc and all those things. So just throwing in an explosion or a sex scene or whatever can bring drama, but it won't be the meaningful drama that keeps your readers reading.
It's not always the stuff that's happening that is making the reader read it. It's what's happening to the character.
So yeah, you've got drama that is fed to your readers that they enjoy reading, but if it's not meaningfully affecting the character, then it doesn't have a purpose.
Right.
So the point is that these disasters that happen, while your readers are experiencing it, it's your characters that are truly experiencing it.
Right. And that's why those disasters can't be happening independently of each other. They all kind of link together and create the arc of the character throughout the story, and they change in the end.
Which is, I think, where the next sets of chapters are going to be going. So that will be very useful.
And then after this,
there's a lot more.
12 additional tips, which we are not going to read all of them here, but you can get them in our chapter notes. We'll each pick a favorite. Okay, so one of my favorites was a strategy. I'm a very strategy-driven person. If I see a problem in my life, I go out of my way to try to think of some strategy, which is actually causing problems sometimes. But when I find a problem in my writing and I get a good strategy, I am like all for it. And he gives one. He says, chances are that if you make a list of 6 or 8 possible disasters that would work, one of them, well down the list from your first idea, will be fresher, brighter, worse for the lead character, and not predictable by the reader. You always want the reader kept guessing. And I was like, that's how you come up with cool shit to happen in your story. And that's unpredictable.
Right, because it wasn't your first choice. So it won't be the reader's first choice.
Exactly. So I'm like, oh my gosh, every scene I'm going to write down, well, memoir, things are only going to happen one way. But I could imagine for fiction writers writing down like 8 things that could possibly happen and then picking one down their list. That's a really good strategy for creating a compelling plot.
What was your favorite? I liked number 9. The heart of it is people are not always entirely rational. Given a stressful conflict segment, you can allow your character to blow up or make some stupid mistake. Sometimes you come up with such a strong idea of this is what the character is, so he must proceed through the scene in this way. Sometimes it doesn't work for the plot. So you are allowed every so often for the character just to completely mess up or to snap at somebody or do something that humans do on occasion. They aren't always the paragons of justice.
This does sound like, though, it goes against Bickham's point in a couple of previous chapters about cause and effect and the world having to make sense in a book, don't you think?
No, because you have a reason why the character would blow up at somebody. You do have your cause and effect that puts into play. But say you have a character that is incredibly peaceful and nature loving and you need her to snap. Well, maybe you just wheedle her, and she snaps at just the wrong point to make somebody walk off that they need for later on in the scene. But you put the cause and effect to get her to that point. What he's saying is characters are allowed a certain amount of irrationality or surprise.
I see. Do we have an example?
Well, I was actually personally thinking of an episode of She-Ra where Perfuma is having a bad day with a particular person, and she comments that every morning I wake up and greet the day and find my center, but today somebody woke me up early and I don't have it.
Nice. That's a great show.
So you can have a character have certain characteristics and you are allowed to break them so long as you have good cause and effect for it happening.
Okay. If you want the rest of these, you're going to have to
come check out the Patreon account. Renee is going to do some excellent snark notes, and we can all contribute a little bit to them as well at the end.
Yeah, they do take a long time, dear listener, to write, but I think they are quite entertaining, and there's lots of fun examples. I put all sorts of geeky stuff in there.
Anyway, on to the exercise.
On to the exercise. So this is a process exercise, and I am really excited about it because it doesn't necessarily involve the pains of writing your book. It's about preparing, and I will find any reason I can to avoid writing. Okay, so note card strategy.
Note cards.
Do you want to read it? Or do you want me to read it?
Oh, you go for it.
Okay, you have to get some note cards, some flash cards. Take 6 5x7 file cards. At the top of each card, write the word goal, and then fill out in 10 words or less what your central character wants in this scene. 2 lines below, write the word conflict and write down who the conflict is to be with, where the conflict is to take place, how long in story time the conflict is to last, and at least four twists or turns that the conflict is to take during its playing out.
Depending on the size of your hand ready, you may need to get one of the big note cards.
Or you could be really savvy and you could like get an Excel spreadsheet and do it on that. Near the bottom of the card, write the word disaster. Write down what disaster would be for this scene. If you can make some of them hook together, one behind the other in cause and effect fashion, so much the better. For that's what you do when you plot.
I've heard of lots of people that use note cards for plotting their scenes.
Yes, and I kind of wondered what they were doing with those note cards, or like what was on those note cards.
Often you just write a scene, but this has more of a formula, so you can kind of see how they all fit together. It's not just kind of random writing. There's a very specific way it's going to show up. I'm going to use this method and try to come up with a whole bunch of the scenes for my story. And they don't have to be linear. So I might just go for some of the highlight scenes that I've been in my head and just get them down on paper and get them worked out.
So I'm not actually sure how this is going to come out when I start doing it. But I think this is very helpful for me because I do get kind of lost in my memoir and where things are going. So I'm going to maybe do both. I will come up with the big stuff and put them in order. But then I'm also maybe going to pick one chapter and find all the scenes and do all of them. So it would be kind of reverse engineering.
Sounds good.
Bam.
All right, let's go do this.
Yeah. So we're back to the activity portion of the podcast.
Let's actually start off with how did this go for you?
This has been a very interesting exercise because I'm technically not writing fiction. I am writing memoir. And there are many different types of creative nonfiction and how it can be shaped. I don't know if it actually falls into this shape. It can. If it's written like a novel, it can. But mine tends to be more essay-like than it is chapters. But there are scenes. So it did kind of work. It was kind of a weird sort of. I don't know. But how about you, Kim? How did it work out for you?
For me, it worked really well. My novel is clearly genre fiction. It's clearly page-turner. And it is made up of scenes. So once I got my approach, it was fine. But I had a hard time coming up with just brand new scenes off the top of my head because I'm a discovery writer, which means I'm not quite sure the particulars until I get down to writing it. And just simply doing an outline gets very dry for me and it doesn't really engage me. So I purposely leave off all the little twists and turns until I'm writing a scene. However, I had an entire chapter I got kind of a rough version on, which was working more or less and was composed of a bunch of scenes. So I went through that chapter and identified all the scenes. And it was interesting what came about when I tried to match the scenes there with what Bickham expected from a scene.
So you used this more as a revision tactic other than like a prepare to write a scene process.
Right. I got to one place where I hadn't written anything down. It was very nebulous. And I realized I didn't know what to do for my twists for that scene. And I really won't know what to do with this twist until I come up with a rough draft. And then I'll be able to dig in and use this technique to really identify what those four twists are.
That's interesting. So in the chapter, Bickham was specifically saying, do this before you write your chapter. But it looks like it's applicable in both ways. The terms are outliner versus discovery writer. So you're a discovery writer.
Yes. So I could not come up with these off the top of my head. I can come up with big things up the top of my head, but this is really drilling down to the minuscule of a scene. Some of the twists are tiny twists, and I just can't come up with those until I'm right in the middle of that scene and feeling how it goes.
Right. It's more organic for you.
Yeah.
What was the stuff you ended up changing according to these cards?
I'm going to focus on the final scene in this chapter. I actually read the first scene for our bonus podcast last week, the one where the militia guard needs to train the incoming hero to be a fighter. And we went through that and looked at how it matched Bickham's scene. And as this chapter progresses, it's all about taking these people from our world that have been plopped into a fantasy world and need to become heroes. And they've been assigned classes. It's all about them learning how to fit these classes. So after the scene where one character learns how to be a fighter, then we have a scene where one character learns how to be a ranger, and then one character learns how to be a cleric. And finally, we get to the character that's a rogue and how he learns to be a rogue. And it made perfect sense for the first three because I'd already created characters from that world that were a fighter, a ranger, and a cleric. But the problem was there aren't any rogues in the story so far. And this is something I thought of a while back when I was thinking about the scene. I was thinking, who the heck is going to train Cole the rogue? And then I realized I already had the character I needed. It's going to be the raccoon.
Is there a raccoon?
There's a raccoon, yeah. The ranger has a beast companion that's a raccoon.
Does he talk kind of like?
He doesn't talk at all.
Okay.
You know, if there's an archetype to train a rogue, I would think that a raccoon would fit the bill.
It's a smart raccoon.
Right. So the scene was going to play out where the raccoon came to Cole the rogue and convinced him to follow the raccoon. And he was going to take him to a human that was a thief that would train him more specifically. It wasn't like the raccoon was going to teach him lockpicking skills or anything like that. But the raccoon would know who to hook him up with.
I'm a little disappointed. I kind of want the raccoon to do it.
Anyway, so the scene was to be the raccoon contacts the rogue, convinces him that he can help the rogue, leads him to this thief, and then the thief would further train the rogue. And I was thinking it would all be one scene, because if the scene goal is, will the raccoon Cornelius train Cole, then it was all the way through. But I realized that once Cole gets to this thief to train him, Cornelius' scene is over for the understanding we have of what the scene goal is. So the scene goal was Cornelius must convince Cole to trust him so that Cornelius can help Cole become a rogue. And the scene ends when Cole is following Cornelius because he trusts him.
I see.
So that was the first thing I realized is that your scenes may be shorter than you think they are. In order to get that immediacy, in order to get that finality, you may have several scenes within a period where things are happening linearly and there's no breaks.
Did it end in a disaster?
Yeah, so let's keep going on this. So you have to come up with four twists.
Mm-hmm.
I have to question, was it hard for you to come up with four twists for your scenes?
Yes. Because some of them, like you said, are so short. There's not a lot of exchange. It's like, it's just a line of dialogue. There can't be more twists because there's no more dialogue.
Right. And this is an advantage that I have. And I did make four twists per scene. This caused me to reevaluate how my characters interacted.
Mm-hmm.
I realized I needed to have an element of conflict in each of the interactions because the original writing of the scene has very little of Cole rejecting the raccoon. It's much more of they meet up and very soon Cole, the rogue, realizes that the raccoon's there to help him. But that didn't actually have much tension to it. So I had to come up with some various things. And so the first twist was that Cornelius gets distracted by a thought and suddenly he doesn't know where Cole is. So he had to chase him down. And then the next one is that when Cornelius shows up, initially Cole doesn't trust him at all. And so there's a conflict right there. Cornelius has to work to gain Cole's trust or has to manipulate the situation to get Cole to pay attention to him. And then in twist number three is when Cornelius actually gets Cole to trust him. He uses this really cute raccoon face on him with really big eyes. And then finally, the final bit is very easy. Cornelius just needs to get Cole to follow him. So he runs along a little bit and looks back at Cole.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cole starts to follow him. And then the disaster is the final line, which I was including anyway. It wasn't in the middle of the scene because I assumed this was a much longer scene. And it became the final line, which is that, yes, Cornelius gets Cole to follow him. But Cole tells him, don't let anyone know I got help from a raccoon.
He's got to save some face.
Exactly. What I found was really interesting was by forcing me to put these twists in, I actually revealed a lot more of the characters than I had originally. By having Cole not trust Cornelius, I actually got more into Cole's personality and why he well, not why he wouldn't trust a raccoon, but why he would be distrustful of everything going on around him.
Right.
So yeah, that was my exercise. And I got 6 cards out of the chapter. So I did my half dozen.
So there's 6 scenes then in that chapter.
There ended up being 6 scenes. Yeah.
If you turn this in as an assignment, do you think that you followed the exercise as intended?
Given that I can't come up with these things off the top of my head, yes. Because I really looked at each of the scenes and I identified those points. When you're doing it on note cards, you can't do as much hand waving, you know? Like in our other exercises where we were analyzing our various scenes, it was easy to kind of say, oh yeah, and this sort of happens here. And the prose would carry it along. But when you're actually writing out on note cards, it has to be a twist. It has to be, who are the two people in conflict?
So are you going to keep this method? Is this going to be part of your like revision process now?
It'll be in my toolbox. This worked well because there was a series of short scenes. My next chapter is going to be largely between two characters in a situation where there's more conversing. So I don't know if it's going to work out for that or not.
Wouldn't that be called a scene though?
Right, but if it's a long chapter, I think I might run into problems that I don't quite have the back and forth or the plot twists to fill it up. Actually, here's the thing. In these ones, I had a whole bunch of external action, and I'm not sure if I'm going to have as much external action or more internal exposition in the next scene.
I see.
In the next chapter.
So this is mostly a success.
I would definitely say this was a success.
If somebody's debating whether or not they should be trying this note card strategy, who do you think would most benefit?
That's a really good question. I think any action scene or any scene where your character's moving through stuff, this is a big help because it breaks it down to a series of steps and it makes you come up with what the conflict is at each of those steps. Because it's too easy, especially when you're writing your first draft, to just want to get your characters from point A to point B and just to like explain how things go, and you want things to be working out well. But to approach your scene and say, no, where is the conflict here? How do I end this scene where the character doesn't get everything that they want is very different than how do I get my character to do this thing?
Yeah, cool.
The other thing that works really well too is since everything has to be external, each of my twists had to come from something external happening. Like my twist number one, that Cornelia gets distracted. Initially, wasn't going to have him be distracted. I was going to have him come meet Cole right away and start the scene. But I wanted Cornelius to be thinking about certain things. I wanted to get the right timing for him to show up and meet up with Cole. And so I needed to introduce this distraction and losing Cole just to get my twists in. But also it makes the scene more dynamic.
So it seemed like this was kind of a success in various different ways.
Definitely was a success.
Excellent.
And we will talk about yours in our bonus podcast.
Yes. So, dear listener, if you would like more, please come to Patreon. And there you can get the bonus episode. And for this episode, it will be me talking about my process using these note cards for memoir. You'll also get very thorough chapter notes and broken down examples to help you do these activities on your own and to understand the concepts of Bickham. We've also got activities on there for you to do. You can do the activity and post it, and the first 3 that post will get feedback from me and Kim. We also have some polls, and we have some community posts that you can make. So head over onto Patreon and support your local creator or local maker or whoever we are.
Fantastic. All right, listeners, see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.
Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
All right, I have to redo that because I can't remember Jack Bickham's book title. It's Scene and Sequence, Scene and Style, Scene and Structure. It's got a really unmemorable title.